From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me.
My guest is Ann Soon Choi, as she has written a fascinating biography of the coroner to the stars called L.A. Coroner, Thomas Noguchi, and Death in Hollywood. Ann Soon Choi, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to meet you. I don't really enjoy true crime genre stuff because I find that most of the books in that genre are like lurid and like there's another true crime story on TV every 5 minutes. But your book has the best elements of a true crime book as well as, you know, fascinating stories about racial prejudice and ego and a very complex central character, Thomas Noguchi. So thank you for writing such a great book. How'd you get interested in this?
So sometime, it must have been the late 90s or early 2000, I was most likely avoiding writing my dissertation. And I was in New York City for part of that year. And I had a very limited budget that I lived on. And so I would buy books at the Strand bookstore in the dollar bin outside. And they always had a mystery bin. And I'm a big, I love mysteries and true crime. And I found his memoir about his most famous cases called Coroner. And I just picked it up because it was so unusual. It had been written in 1982, if I'm correct. And here it was just waiting for me. And I had never seen a true crime book, let alone a mystery written by someone Asian American. I guess Amy Tan was supposed to satisfy everybody and all readers in that time period. And Amy Tan is wonderful, but for folks who are interested in mystery Asian American communities, those not readily available. But that has significantly changed. And then, so I took it to a cafe and started to read it, couldn't put it down. And then, subsequently, I eventually finished my dissertation and moved a lot of places, but I always took that book with me. It never made it into the giveaway pile because something about the story stayed with me. And then, in 2017, I started to do some archival work, partly because I could no longer really travel extensively to do research because I had a newborn and I was at home. I had a sabbatical year that year as well, and then decided that I would think about maybe testing the waters and putting out an article about Thomas Noguchi. And then I discovered the case where he is fired the first time and how the Japanese American community, along with the Black community and Mexican American community, come together in support of Thomas Noguchi and his reinstatement. And I found an amazing story there. And I was fortunate that my closest friend from graduate school, Christopher West, connected me to some of the key players in the story. And then the project took off. I was really fortunate that the article was published and won a prize in my field. And I thought I was done. I had reached the pinnacle of my historian goals, that I had won that award. I could retire and just forever be happy. And but the project kind of took on a life of its own, and here it is.
Well, Thomas Noguchi lives. He's still alive, right? Have you met him?
I have, and I met him in the most unusual circumstance. It was serendipitous. He had a pretty significant firewall around him, and in terms, you know, I reached out both to the University of Southern California, where he was on the faculty. I reached out to the coroner's office. I sent letters and could never get a hold of him in this time period. And I think part of it, if I had to guess, is that I think a lot of people reach out to him because he is involved in so many of these famous cases. So it was impossible. But then I unfortunately had to have eye surgery, multiple eye surgeries, in the last 18 months or so. I do not recommend eye surgery. Zero stars. It's terrible. But I was at the Roski Eye Clinic here in Los Angeles, and my husband was with me. And I was having my eye surgery done when my husband heard the name Thomas Noguchi, and he looked up, and there he was at the Roski Eye Clinic. And so I come out of surgery, and my husband's like telling me, I'm in pain. I have a patch over my eye. Like, I'm dressed in sweatpants. I look like a pirate gone awry. My husband's trying to, I'm like, I can't talk about the book right now. I really can't talk about the book. He's like, no. Thomas Noguchi is here. And so I go and I see him there, and he's with his foster daughter, and who was so gracious. They were wonderful. And I got to meet Thomas Noguchi, and I showed him the cover of the book. The manuscript was done at this point.
Wow.
And so I got to meet him, and then he invited me over for coffee and to his house. So I went to his house. I sat in a garden, a beautiful garden with Thomas Noguchi. He gave me persimmons to take home. And he was absolutely lovely and gracious, and it was just such a highlight of this whole book writing process to meet him.
It's so unusual. I mean, so you wrote the entire book before meeting him, and
yeah,
that's so great. So do you know if he's read it?
He has not read it. In fact, I will be seeing him very soon. I'm going to take a copy to him. And he is 98,
right.
But he is still quite busy, and so I hope he'll read it, and I would love to get his thoughts on it, it was wonderful to meet him.
Well, I mean, it's complimentary in the fact that you wrote a book about him to begin with, but he is a kind of a complex character, and you don't shy away from, you know, all the different sides of that character. I mean, one of the things I was thinking of is, you know, today in politics, speaking, you know, of the main guy in politics, you know, he's very reluctant to take responsibility for any mistakes he's made. That was always the other guy. And sort of see, you tell me, do you think Thomas Noguchi had an aversion to blame?
Think so. I think he was in this time period, he really got to in many ways invent. And he is a master of reinvention. And he's hard charging in a way that was not unusual in LA County politics. And as far as I can tell, in the time period, I don't see anyone else apologizing either. And so I don't think Thomas Noguchi had to apologize either. So
nobody was doing it. So therefore,
yeah, no one.
So Ahn-Soon Choi, did you have to do some research into what a coroner does exactly? Did you know anything about that before?
I did. You know, everything, at least initially, what I knew about what a coroner did, I am fortunate for the legacy of Law and Order and every sort of forensic informed show, which, by the way, would not exist without Thomas Noguchi.
He's my claim. Popularized it. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I will stand by it. And so it did require a lot of research. I am an academic, and so I read lots of academic articles. I read textbooks to familiarize myself with how an autopsy worked, a lot of, you know, how the work of the coroner was transformed in the 60s, and also the sort of interface between the work of a coroner, medical examiner, and the legal system.
About to enter the fascinating sphere of police work. the world of forensic medicine.
Is it true that Quincy is based on Thomas Noguchi? That is the
It is. And Thomas Noguchi and Jack Klugman were friends, and very much he provided a lot of the context for the shows. And, you know, the sad thing, though, is that they could not cast an Asian American actor in the lead role. And so Robert Ito sort of plays sort of as a sidekick, as was the norm in the time.
It is sad, isn't it? Today, that wouldn't be the case, and that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I was asking you about the research you've done into coroners, and you were saying you'd interviewed some coroners as well.
Yes, I had, before he passed away, I had interviewed Cyril Weck, who was a contemporary of Thomas Noguchi's, and they were very good friends as well. And I had interviewed some death investigators to talk about, you know, to learn about how a death investigation unfolded. And it was really eye-opening. And of course, just that all this work was done under, you know, the auspices of being a county employee and sort of the very quotidian nature of being a county employee was really fascinating.
Well, although an Asian American couldn't play a coroner on TV, in fact, there was an Asian American coroner. So how difficult was that for him? What hurdles did he have to jump to become?
I think it was tremendously difficult for him. You know, this was, you know, when he started, you know, his training in the U.S. and then joined the coroner's office. It was not long after the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II. And their subsequent return, when this happened in LA, they were faced with significant anti-Japanese sentiment that, you know, at times was violent and at other times, right, very much circumscribed the lives of people who are trying to rebuild after the war. And Thomas Noguchi is a Shinisei, so a new Japanese immigrant in this time period. And he, in ways that were very, I think, surprising for him, he at times until very much, I think, until he becomes coroner, was not fully cognizant of the sort of racial discrimination that Japanese Americans experienced. But he becomes part and parcel of that. There's no way for anyone to really distinguish, you know, precisely, you know, when and how he came to the U.S. And then so he has that, working against him, and that he's an immigrant, and he had powerful forces that worked against him. So when he has the opportunity to take the civil service exam and vie for the chief coroner's job, both the County Medical Association, which is very powerful in this time period, and both the medical schools of UCLA and USC speak out against him. And I thought USC was really just sort of ironic because they said that there was absolutely no way that someone like Thomas Noguchi could teach in their medical school, which is what the coroners did, the chief coroner did, to offset their very, very low county salaries. But what he didn't know was that Thomas Noguchi was already teaching for USC. And so I thought that was very ironic. But so he has all these forces against him. But what saves him is that he's a county employee, and the county employee has to go by the civil service, right? The civil service procedure. He scores in the top three, and he takes the exam with his wife's encouragement. And so he lands in the top three. And then despite all the sort of machinations of the medical school, the county medical association, some of the board of supervisors, you know, who are all working against him, what happens is that the entire county employee organization come out in support of Thomas Noguchi because they want to protect the civil service system. They understand that this system protects jobs, it protects promotions, and they were not going to let people interfere with it. And so rather than seeing this, right, like I think maybe some in the time period wanted to see this as a moment of sort of racial progress. Not so much. It was really that the county employees wanted to protect county jobs. And what I think is very interesting is that at the very end of his career, when he retires from the county in 1999, so he has worked for the county for over 30 years, he says he enjoyed every minute of it. And the very fact that even at the height of his career, he wouldn't even consider another job. He had a deep loyalty to the county because the civil service system allowed him to become the coroner.
We're talking with Ann Soon Choi, and she has written a book about Thomas Noguchi, and it's called L.A. Coroner, Thomas Noguchi and Death in Hollywood. Your book begins with the death of John Belushi, and I think you chose that because it exemplifies what expertise as a coroner can do. So could you talk about that exactly? How does that expertise influence that case?
Yeah. So Thomas Noguchi at this time, you know, he is at sort of a low point in his career. He's being investigated. He knows that there are serious things happening, and you know that he's already been cautioned by the Board of Supervisors not to speak to the public in terms of, you know, the sort of glad handing that he did with the media and what he was known for, but to keep quiet. And so John Belushi, right, is found dead, and in Noguchi, he calls to the scene, and the police are already there. And the police, like, he's well known. He's well known to the police, to the LAPD. He's well known to the sheriff's department, to the extent where they called it the Noguchi show. So he was very theatrical. He was very media savvy, and in many ways, you know, he was sort of the OG influencer in the way he knew how to manipulate the media, how to generate a soundbite, et cetera. And so what he does, and so the police, the police plus the original detectives on the scene say that, okay, well, you know, clearly, you know, this is a heart attack. And so they find Belushi, you know, on the ground. And so this is a heart attack. And then, and Noguchi does a survey of the room, and he's like, no, he's like, this is a young man. It can't be a heart attack. And then so what he does is that he approaches the body, and then he had what they called his kind of signature move, where he would crouch down by the body to begin the process of investigation. And what he did was that he lifted up Belushi's arm, and then he squeezed right in the crook of his arm until a drop of blood appeared. And then he's like, well, this was no heart attack, right? This is clearly a drug related death. And then that was ultimately true. But he was very skilled, as you know, in terms of his technical and his scientific skills. And so I think what made him really interesting is that he had this sort of over the top persona, but at the same time, he knew what he was doing.
Right.
And so, I think that, that made for, you know, a very interesting person. And there are people from the time, you know, just, you know, people who talked about the best part about, you know, reading the LA Times was figuring out what Thomas Noguchi was up to. And then, and people commented they had never found the county so entertaining. And so I thought that was interesting as well.
Very. Well, I mean, of course, you and you know, he is the coroner to the stars, and there were a lot of famous people that he whose bodies he investigated. But how many autopsies happen every day in Los Angeles?
You know, I don't know that number currently, but I do know that in the time period where he worked, it like what you saw over the span of his career is exactly at the same time that LA as a metropolis is expanding. And so what you see is a dramatic uptick in unexplained deaths in which the coroner would have to be involved. And, you know, like today, the coroner's office was underfunded and short-staffed, and this meant that almost always it was playing catch-up in terms of the autopsies they needed to perform. And, of course, autopsies are tied to legal proceedings and also and as Thomas Noguchi always pointed out, was that what could, you know, the work that he did, how did it serve the living?
Well, in Quincy, you know, he always sees a crime and he's all enthusiastic about trying to prove that his theories. But it seems like Noguchi doesn't go into it in that same way. Like he just looks at what's there and then reports what he sees, because he doesn't often... He doesn't, you know, some of your stories were kind of left hanging. There's no satisfactory conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, so the life of a coroner and the work of a coroner, unfortunately, cannot be resolved in 38 minutes. and so I think that is part of it. But the work that he did was, you know, in the way that he did it in his time was unusual and it was groundbreaking. For example, we take it for granted now that if you can't identify a body, one way you can do it is through dental records.
Right.
This was not a standard procedure well into the 80s, but it's Thomas Noguchi is the first coroner to employ that.
Every episode of Law and Order has that now.
Yeah, and so that happens after a terrible helicopter accident in Los Angeles, and where the bodies were so, you know, damaged, you know, beyond identification, you know. So how do you identify? And so he pioneers that. And I think if each story doesn't have this kind of nice wrap up. I think what we do have, though, is that every case that he is involved in does have sort of a larger, greater effect.
Well, in the history of my program here from the bookshelf, okay, I've interviewed Robert Wagner, and I interviewed Peter Bogdanovich, who made a film about Natalie Wood and her death. And I interviewed a woman named Susan Finstad, who wrote a book about Natalie Wood. And she is convinced that Robert Wagner is responsible for the death of Natalie Wood and that he mm-hmm. should be indicted. Mm-hmm. And Peter Bogdanovich and Robert Wagner have a different opinion about it. And mm-hmm. that's something that you investigated in your book. So mm-hmm. what do you think?
There are sort of two sets of things right here that the case was reopened. And if I'm correct, Robert Wagner was identified as a person of interest. So there's that. But then there's also, and this case is particularly complicated because Noguchi actually supervises and not actually conducts the autopsy. But what we do see is that very much so he is convinced that if she had not been wearing the heavy red parka, and perhaps if she had not been under the influence of alcohol, perhaps there would have been a different outcome. And, you know, I've read all the books here, and, you know, and sorting through it, I don't know. I don't know. And I think there are two people who do. But I think that's another book.
All right, we'll let that go. In your book, you talk about how what he learned from the Marilyn Monroe, which was very early in his career, about basically being hung out to dry. I mean, how he had to really, going forward, cross every T and dot every I.
Yeah, I think that case really haunted him because he was asked to do the autopsy, and the coroner at the time instead decided he was going to opt to introduce Theodore Kerfey, this thing called the psychological autopsy, and to expand the role of the coroner's office. And Thomas Noguchi would adopt this as well, but to figure out the state of mind of the decedent by doing interviews. And, you know, this is in the same world at a lot of the ways and the procedural things that are linked to the psychological autopsy will sound very familiar to people because it's very much like profiling as well. I think it's in the same realm. But what happens here is that, you know, they're trying to decide, right? Like this is where Kerfey thinks that, well, maybe we can have an explanation. She has a history of overdosing, so let's figure out what's going on. But what it only does is generate more speculation. And once the pills are discovered in her stomach and the autopsy is completed, they don't even bother to run toxicological reports, which haunts Noguchi. But he, at the time as an assistant coroner, has very little power. And it haunts him to the degree where he continually worries at some point, and it's sort of an irrational idea, but the fear is palpable that even he could be accused of killing Marilyn Monroe. And so this haunts him throughout his career. And he is tied forever to that conspiracy. And this takes a life, it takes on a life of its own after he autopsies Robert Kennedy, right? The whole connection between Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedy brothers. Mm-hmm. And so, but what I found fascinating is that even though Thomas Noguchi is, you know, integral to, you know, part of this story, in many ways, he's just a footnote, right? He's largely been written out. And, but I think it's very interesting that when Robert Kennedy, is murdered, he conducts the perfect autopsy.
Yeah, now you say that in the book a couple of times. So what was it that was so perfect about it?
So this was the standard of all the other coroner and medical examiners in the country. And what they want to do is that the autopsy of John F. Kennedy was so botched that this had to be perfect. And I think what also drove Thomas Noguchi was that he wanted to make sure what happened also, right? It wasn't just JFK, but also Marilyn Monroe that was, you know, kind of haunting him. And so, it's a 6-hour autopsy. And as you suggested earlier, every T was crossed, every I was dotted. It was meticulously done. And to the extent that Thomas Noguchi wouldn't even consider moving the body outside of Good Samaritan Hospital. And to even today, when people write about it, they talk about it being the perfect autopsy. Nothing was left, you know, unexamined. And it is sort of the gold standard of autopsies today.
Can you draw any conclusions from his autopsy of Robert Kennedy regarding a second gunman or Sirhan Sirhan's guilt or whatever?
Yeah. And so Noguchi is really cagey about this throughout his career. He will never satisfactorily answer this question. And so maybe I'll follow his lead here. But he does. He does demonstrate through the forensic evidence that very much that it could have been the way that Robert Kennedy was moving through the room, the way that he turned and the trajectory of the bullet, that I think would exclude the idea of a second gunman. And again, this particular, what I find really interesting is that it was already a conspiracy in its time. Right. And it's only grown more so. And what I found really interesting was that even so, when Thomas Noguchi gets dismissed and he's fighting for his job in this period, too, in the aftermath of the perfect autopsy that he did, his lawyer uses even the conspiracy case to point out, you know, just how problematic that, you know, he was trying to link the conspiracy of how the county and the medical association was coming in to then, you know, have Noguchi ousted from his position because maybe he knew too much. And so it was just like the only way I could really think of it was that it was just like thick enough to cut with a knife. And people use the conspiracies for different things. And I think that and conspiracy in and of itself tells us something about the moment that people live in. And what people choose to believe and why. And so I think there's a really interesting parallel there to our current moment.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I'm very confused about conspiracy because when President Kennedy was killed after the Warren Report, like years after, I think it was 1967, when Mark Lane wrote his book, Rush to Judgment, that was the first time we started to really hear about conspiracies. And people who believed there was a conspiracy were generally left-wing, left-leaning, you know, question authority and the credibility gap and all that stuff. Whereas today, conspiracy theories and flat earthers and the QAnon and all the stuff is mostly and the deep state has become a right-wing thing. I'm not sure when it changed over or what the meaning of that is, but it's an odd thing.
It is odd. I think though earlier too, you do have what we would label more conservative groups of people who were deeply involved in conspiracy. If you think of like, you know, McCarthyism, you know, right, the true believers there. If you think about, you know, like here in Southern California, you know, all the sort of revival religious movements, Amy Semple being an example. Mm-hmm. I think you have different pockets of it. But I think, though, in the context of conspiracy with the coroner and right, I think it is a way for people to process terrible information in, I think, some of the things that happened in such close succession in the 60s, made it almost impossible to comprehend for many people. And I think conspiracy goes a long way to offer explanation. And so, you know, the death of, you know, the assassination of both the Kennedys, Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, all in the same period, combined with massive social unrest, you know, and everything no longer seemed right and familiar to a lot of people. And I think that drives people to conspiracy. And I think that is the same dynamic we see today.
I lived in Los Angeles in 1969, and I remember when the Manson case occurred. And I specifically remember before Manson was named that when the crime occurred, the police had said that the LaBianca case was a copycat. I remember hearing that on the news. And Thomas Noguchi was one of the people who drew the correlation that that wasn't a copycat. Is that right?
Yeah. He very much, you know, clearly understood. And this is where he kind of takes his first stint at profiling, knowing what he knew as the coroner. And I think what's very striking about that case, in terms of sort of what was going on in Los Angeles, was that how frightened people were. I think, right, this was still supposed to be the summer of love. This was, right, and this brings everything sort of to a screeching halt. And sort of the fear, and then even, and I don't know if one is less alarming. So is it really someone who's this is a copycat murder, or is this the same killer? Neither one seems particularly comforting to me, but very much Thomas Noguchi was like, no. And so he actually, you know, points out, you know, that the elements of ritual in the killing. The only thing he does not get right here is he doesn't think it can be a woman. Mm. Like, women can't be involved in that, of course, is disproven. And I think one thing that is really overlooked in the whole Manson case and the trial is how important the forensic evidence was to conviction. Because largely in many ways it was circumstantial. Right. And it was the forensic evidence that made conviction possible. And I think a lot of that is lost in how horrific the crimes were. But at the same time, there were all sorts of people jockeying for, you know, the power to tell the story in which they wanted to. And things like the depth of knife wounds, et cetera, don't quite make the front page, I think.
Was his observation that he couldn't be a woman his own sexist belief, or did he, what did he base
on? I don't think, and of course, right, sort of sexism is rampant as it is today, but I think, I don't think it's that belief as much as the understanding of psychology and crime at the time, and that it was believed that women couldn't perpetrate crimes like this. And I think that's a deep-seated belief, and particularly a young woman, right?
Right.
And so the Manson family really changes that, but also still today, we are still, like, if you follow any true crime, but the way that when women are involved, and it's its own genre, because people find it so hard to believe that women can kill. And then, so I think it is very much that dynamic, because for that particular case, because he is involved in other cases where, you know, the outcome has been, you know, a woman who has, you know, poisoned. And I think it was also the manner of death, the violence that led to his sort of, you know, statement that it, you know, that it was not a woman.
And Vincent Bugliosi, the prosecutor in the case, gets a lot of credit for convicting Manson, who was not present at the killing for which he was convicted, and how much did Thomas Noguchi play in that?
Yeah. And I think, again, I think it came down to the forensic evidence, and also the way that his expert testimony during the trial itself, and that when I looked through the transcripts, he didn't set out to titillate or to dramatize. I mean, he was, but at the same time, he was able to translate the forensics into, in a way that made it understandable to not only the jury, but to, you know, just regular, you know, a lay audience.
I want to ask you about the case of the athlete football player who was killed in Pasadena.
Long Beach, Ron Settle.
Oh, Long Beach, Ron Settle. Yeah. And what happened exactly? I mean, it's kind of confusing because there's no real resolution in that case, I guess.
Yeah. So Ron Settles is this football star at what was Long Beach State, which is now Cal State Long Beach. He was stopped in this little city, which is surrounded by Long Beach, called Signal Hill, which had a long history of sort of white supremacy. And it was a place where communities of color knew not to stop or drive if you could avoid it. And so Ron Settles is a young man who drives a sports car and was stopped for speeding and taken into custody. And along the way, he is beaten and brutalized by the Signal Hill police, who deny it, of course.
Yes.
And then he dies while he's in custody, and they suggest that he hung himself. And that was most likely not the case, but this is a really controversial case for Thomas Noguchi, because this, I would identify this as sort of the unraveling of his career, as he, you know, the beginning of the end as his time of coroner. And he, again, does not conduct the autopsy of Ron Settle, but he supervises it as the chief coroner. He's the person in charge. And at this point, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, you know, it's acute, the crisis in the coroner's office about how underfunded it is. Thomas Noguchi is not a great administrator or manager, and lots of things go awry with the case. But what becomes central to this is that many believe that Ron Settles did not hang himself using a mattress cover, which is what the police suggest in his cell, but he is the victim of a chokehold. And the attorney who takes on the case, Johnny Cochran. Before he's Johnny Cochran, you know, argues powerfully that that's what this is. And so this case is part of the long history of LA police, you know, LAPD brutality, particularly toward Black and Brown men. And Thomas Noguchi here does not manage it well. And the case goes sideways. And it's clear that something has broken down in terms of procedure. There's evidence that is contaminated, evidence that is, like, they lose Ron Settle's clothing. The mattress cover was never tested. But then Thomas Noguchi, in this moment, decides that what he needs here is, you know, media attention. And so he stages a reenactment and invites the media, which this is, I think this was a poor decision. And what happens is that he doesn't even use, you know, the person he has subbing for Ron Settles. It, you know, doesn't, you know, it's not the same height, not the same weight. And, you know, it's largely, you know, inconclusive. And this case becomes a problem for him because the losing of the evidence catches the attention of a reporter named Lori Beckland, who then starts an investigative series that has, I think, like 20 something articles that are part of in the LA Times. When the LA Times was at the height of its power in terms of investigative journalism, and that unseats Thomas Noguchi as the coroner.
Well, it's I was saying earlier that I'm not a fan of true crime books, and yet I stayed up all night reading your book. And so if you are a fan of true crime books, I think you'll really enjoy this book called L.A. Coroner, Thomas Noguchi and Death in Hollywood by my guest, Ansu Choi. It's filled with a million true crime stories. I mean, not a million, but 30 true crime stories and lots of biographies of all the people involved. And I think it was a wonderful read, and I congratulate you on such a great book. And I thank you for spending some time with me on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, I really appreciate it. And if any of your listeners would like to follow me on Instagram, I'm at LA True Crime.
Fantastic. Ansu Choi, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really enjoyed our time together.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. Joining us now is Lissa Warren. She is the founder and president of Lissa Warren PR, a company that specializes in book and author publicity. She's active on Twitter at Lissa_Warren, and she is a professor at Emerson College in Boston. And she joins me here on From the Bookshelf. Lissa, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Gary. Good to be with you.
Tell me what you've been reading.
I have been reading Rebel Queen, The Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of a Grand Master. It's by Susan Polgar. It's published by Grand Central Publishing, which is part of the Hachette Book Group, which is one of the big five houses. And it is the true story of one of the most renowned women in chess history. She took on a sexist establishment. She stood up to an authoritarian empire and rewrote the rules of what women could achieve against the oppressive backdrop of Cold War Eastern Europe. Now, Susan Polgar was born to a poor Jewish family in Cold War Budapest, and she would emerge as one of the greatest female chess players that the world has ever seen. While she was still a teenager in 1986, she became the first woman to qualify for the Men's World Chess Championship cycle. And there was no Women's Chess Championship cycle at that time. She would go on to become the highest-rated female chess player on the planet. And at the age of 21, she was the first woman to earn the Men's Grand Master title. And that, my friend, is chess's highest designation. Now, she would make history again later on by becoming the first chess player, male or female, to achieve the game's Triple Crown. And I couldn't tell you exactly what that Triple Crown is, but I know it's super, super rare.
It's the Kentucky Derby, the Belmont, and the Preakness.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. I'm sure that's exactly what it was. At every turn, she was pitted against a sexist culture, a hostile communist government, vicious anti-Semitism, and powerful enemies. And she endured sabotage and betrayal and even an assault. There were men who were just determined to make sure that she would not succeed at their game. And you know what she did in response? She made it her game. She's an incredible lady, and she gave back hugely. She eventually left Hungary, and she started a new life as an American citizen. And while here, she was a chess coach for over 14 years. She built two separate chess dynasties at colleges, one at Texas Tech in Lubbock and one at Webster University in St. Louis. And she led those teams to more national titles, world championships, and major titles and Olympiad medals than all other college chess teams combined. So she really made something of herself and paved the way for many other people, women and men, to do the exact same thing in the world of chess.
So
this is her story.
Her memoir.
It's a memoir written by her.
Yeah, wow, how great. And I mean, like everybody who's seen Queen's Gambit, I'm interested in this because that was such a great show.
Yeah. It
sounds like that's who she is. She's the Queen's Gambit gal.
A lot of people, when that came out, said, hey, it, you know, Susan, it's just based on you. It's not. But when you watch the show and when you read the book, you see how people could think that. I mean, she really was like the quintessential female chess player for a very long time. And it was fraught and full of drama in so many different ways, just like in the show. So, well, yeah, I see the similarities.
Yeah. And she's written quite a few chess books as well.
She has. And those I have not read and those I will not read because I do not play chess, but I still really enjoyed this book. I mean, I liked the like Eastern European history as much as I liked some of the chess stuff, but it, to her credit, in this memoir, she doesn't dissect tournaments, you know, move by move, play by play. She really doesn't do that. So even if you're not a chess player, you'll still enjoy the book. But yes, to your point, there are actual like chess manuals that she has authored that teach people how to play.
Well, you could learn by reading her book of how to teach yourself chess in 24 hours.
I believe that, but I'm bad at it. You have to think many moves ahead, and my mind doesn't work that way. I'm very much in the present.
Well, so, have you tried checkers at all?
I have tried checkers. I can play checkers. I can do Connect Four. I can do Yahtzee. I can do
Scrabble.
But I can't do chess. I tried. I'm bad at it.
Well, this sounds like a really good book. It's Rebel Queen, the Cold War, Misogyny, and the Making of a Grandmaster. And how do you say her name? Susan Polgar?
Polgar, yes. And really, like, who wouldn't want to buy a book with the word misogyny in the title? Like, how in the subtitle? How often do you see that? I feel like never.
Yeah.
Like, not in a book you'd want to read, but yet this is a narrative and wonderfully written and such a great book. I really enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for telling us about it, Lissa, and it's always good to talk to you here on From the Bookshelf, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program, and we'll come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.